World News Today, brought to you by Admiral Corporation, world's largest manufacturer of radio phonographs with automatic record changers. This program is presented in behalf of Admiral dealers all over America. By shortwave broadcast, direct from important overseas stations and leading news centers in our own country, CBS reporters are waiting to bring you first-hand news from the world's political and battlefronts. Now, here's Robert Trout.
Units of the United States fleet are in Sagami Bay, the body of water through which ships must pass to reach Tokyo Bay. From the place where these two bays join, the city limits of Tokyo are only 22 miles away. But there's no news yet on how far up Sagami Bay the American warships have steamed, nor is there word of how many ships or what types have detached themselves from the great fleet of 400 now standing off the coast to enter the inland waters of Japan. Columbia's correspondent, Gene Ryder, with the fleet, said about an hour ago it appeared the fleet would move into Tokyo Bay within a few hours. General MacArthur, the Supreme Allied Commander, is proceeding with plans that have been kept fluid. Changes can be made quickly in details without upsetting the basic arrangements for the occupation. We've already seen some changes due to weather, and it's possible that more may be necessary before the entire program has been carried out. The Japanese, perhaps because of their damaged communication facilities, seem to be having a hard time keeping up with the shifts in the timetable. Tokyo has notified headquarters in Manila that the Japanese vessel, which was supposed to meet the American fleet units and guide them through Sagami Bay, was not on hand at the scheduled time and place. According to Tokyo, the pilot vessel received the message that the occupation had been postponed for 48 hours, but did not receive the later message that the fleet units would enter Sagami Bay Sunday, Japanese time. Therefore, Tokyo says, the Japanese vessel turned back. But there's no reason to believe that the absence of the pilot vessel disrupted Admiral Halsey's plans. Apparently, the American warships have gone right ahead just as they had intended, and when next heard from, there's little doubt that the ships of the United States Navy will be closer to the city of Tokyo than they have ever been since Japan entered the Second World War. This incident seems typical of the entire procedure for entering and occupying the country of the enemy. Sudden changes have to be made. Storms blow up out of the Pacific. Airfields become unsafe for landings. The Japanese announce that they are unable to fulfill some requirement or other. Messages are sent out and vanish without reaching their destination. Apparently, the Japanese either are not used to moving with such speed and efficiency, or the ravages of war are hampering their movements more than had been expected. But despite all the difficulties in making the details fit together, the broad program moves on. The vast Allied war machine closes in on the enemy's home islands, and the great moment draws inexorably closer. There's no evidence that the Japanese are now deliberately delaying. At first, that was the tactic the enemy used. But a week ago, when the Japanese representatives reached Manila, it was the Supreme Allied Commander who set the pace for the operations to follow. From last Sunday on, General MacArthur has determined how swiftly the Allied armed forces should move toward Japan. The timetable since then has depended on his judgment, taking into consideration such factors as the weather, the ability of the Japanese to carry out their instructions properly and promptly, and the complicated maneuvering necessary to bring the Allied troops and ships and planes at full strength into the Japanese homeland in a certain order. The Allied military commanders can be trusted to guard against Japanese treachery as the moment of signing the document approaches. But today the Russian publication Pravda warns the Allies of a different, more subtle treachery which can be guarded against by the Allied statesmen rather than the soldiers and sailors. Pravda says that Japan's ruling clique is trying to repeat the 1918 tactics of the German General Staff, shielding war criminals, preserving their staffs and their machinery. In other words, says the Moscow paper, they intend to prepare revenge. And now for our first switch abroad. For a report from General MacArthur's headquarters, Admiral takes you to CBS Manila, George Murad reporting.
From all we can gather in Manila this Monday morning, the next few days before the various occupation forces actually land are going to be even more hectic and confused than during the past week. But it must be remembered that a sprawling empire has collapsed and the result is a scramble. It's all strangely reminiscent of the collapse of Germany and the Balkans. A few questions about who will administer the Far East and how seem to be getting a bit clearer. Hong Kong will be occupied by a British fleet, landing in the next couple of days. And the Chinese, while they reserve their right to a later claim on the Crown Colony, will not enter with their troops. We've had a message from Shanghai saying that an advanced group of Americans has arrived. Chinese troops are policing the city, and Allied prisoners of war have or shortly will be released. Many of these prisoners were moved up from Hong Kong. Japanese sentries are still standing guard in the settlement, but merely waiting to surrender. The report says Shanghai is almost untouched by war. That's extremely good news and almost unbelievable after one has looked at the shambles of Manila and considered what conditions in much-bombed Tokyo must be. It means that the Chinese will have at least one large industrial city and the most important port in the Orient with which to start rebuilding their nation. General Wiedemeyer says that American Army headquarters will be set up in Shanghai, which bodes well for continued lend-lease. America is also going to have some interest in what happens farther north. Although the Red Army is still fighting on Sakhalin Island, has occupied a considerable part of Korea, and is pushing deep into Manchuria, General MacArthur announced a few hours ago that the 24th United States Army Corps will land in Korea, south of 38 degrees north latitude. It thus appears that General Hodges' men will occupy approximately the southern half of Korea, perhaps at the port of Gyeongju, and including the important city of Busan. This area lies in the same latitude as Weihaiwei, Shifu, and Qingdao, the former British and American naval bases in the Gulf of Chile. In these hectic days, there is reason for sober consideration about how the interests of the big four powers are going to be solved with reasonable justice. Some of the pessimists here believe in the absence of a clear assurance from Russia that the boundaries of influence are going to be set by whose troops get where first. Some people feel, in view of the principal burden which Americans carried in this war, that we're being just a little shy now. Admiral Spruance told us yesterday that America would not seek to establish bases on the Asiatic coast, and probably not on Formosa, due to what he calls the danger of political involvement. This is George Murad in Manila. I return you now to Admiral in New York.
Next, a word from Warren Sweeney.
Complete victory over Japan has brought a lot closer your dream of owning an Admiral radio phonograph with an automatic record changer. You're going to enjoy loading your Admiral automatic record changer with 10 or 12 of your favorite records and hearing them perfectly played one after another without any long waits in between. This will be possible for the first time because the new Admiral changer will change records in 5 seconds. That's right, just 5 seconds. The closing strains of one selection will hardly have died away before the next one will begin. Your Admiral will give you complete enjoyment of recorded music at its best. There will be other improvements, too. Fewer moving parts assure longer life to your Admiral record changer. Featherlight tone arm makes possible noiseless reproduction and high fidelity of tone. Admiral will give you new cabinet beauty and styling, too. So plan now to make your dream come true. For a radio phonograph with the best of everything for your listening pleasure, own an Admiral, America's smart set. Now here once again is Robert Trout.
Next, for a recording made by CBS correspondent Gene Ryder from a battleship off Japan, Admiral takes you to San Francisco.
The fleet has been ready since DJ Day to go ahead with its part of occupying Japan. Its landing force has been standing by, and a large fleet of minesweepers has been waiting to enter Tokyo Harbor. It's known that there are several hundred mines around the harbor, but the minesweeper men expect to have far more trouble with American mines dropped by B-29. But due to delays elsewhere, the fleet landing force, the Third Fleet, and the British Pacific Fleet have been patrolling around off Tokyo long enough to wear a groove in the ocean. But now, after one false start, it looks as though the Navy's first phase of this operation can start within a few hours. And as you know, the whole operation means the seizure of the Yokosuka Naval Base, 39 miles south of Tokyo. The fleet is all set to transform that base and Tokyo Harbor overnight into an American naval base and harbor. The typhoon that caused the delay in flights of airborne troops to Japan hasn't interfered with the fleet as it moves ahead. For the first time since VJ Day, planes from Third Fleet Carrier Task Force 38 are keeping an air umbrella over Tokyo and eastern Honshu. The primary mission of the Navy pilots is to seek out prisoner of war camps, and according to reports from carriers, a number of camps have been located. Large numbers of prisoners were seen yesterday loading up at the low-flying Navy pilot. Flyers say they've encountered no Japanese opposition of any kind in their patrols over the homeland. This is Gene Ryder with the Third Fleet off Tokyo. I return you to Admiral, New York.
In Washington, congressional committees are preparing hearings on the future of atomic energy. For details, Admiral takes you to CBS Washington, Tris Coffin reporting.
Some of America's best brains will try to peer down the dark and lonely corridors of the future. Some of America's best brains will try to peer down the dark and lonely corridors of the future. The long official silence on atomic energy will be lifted just enough for the world to get a glimpse of a new era. The scene, one of the stately white marble hearing rooms in a Senate office building. The characters, the Senate Military Affairs and Commerce Committee sitting as a jury. Scientists, generals, industrialists, labor leaders, and cabinet members will plead their cases. The narrow specific issue is the future of scientific research in the United States. The science bill, which will be discussed at these hearings, calls for continued federal research in peacetime. But the broad ethical question is, what is man going to do with these terrible forces he has unleashed upon the world? Already, bitter debate is raging behind the scenes in Washington over who will control research and development of atomic power. The War Department has squatter's rights. It controls atomic research now and has no intention of releasing it. In fact, the War Department is drawing up a bill which stakes out its claim. The Army position is quite simple. Atomic energy is the most destructive force known to man. Thus, it must be tightly controlled by those whose business is death and destruction. A sharply opposite view is taken by a group of senators, including Kilgore and Pepper, and Secretary of Commerce Henry Wallace. They say that atomic power should be used to better mankind, that the government should turn over its cruel inventions for war to constructive purposes, that funds should be provided to put all the best scientific minds of the country at work on this program. Still a third view is beginning to show its head in Washington, to turn control of atomic power over to the Social and Economic Council of the United Nations. Those who favor this argue that the secrets of atomic power will be open to the world in a matter of a few years anyway. President Truman is keenly aware of the conflicts over atomic power and has indicated he is not sold on the Army position. I return you to Admiral in New York.
Admiral takes you to Chungking, Ed Sauter, Jr. reporting.
This is Ed Sauter, Jr. in Chungking. 2 days ago, the legislative branch of the government of China ratified the new Sino-Soviet Treaty of Friendship and Alliance. The terms of that treaty have now been made public. Here is a brief summary of the principal clauses. 1. Soviet Russia agrees to render China moral and material assistance in the form of military and other supplies. Such assistance is to be given exclusively to the government of Chiang Kai-shek. 2. Soviet Russia reaffirms her respect for China's full sovereignty in Manchuria. 3. China agrees to recognize the full independence of Outer Mongolia if, after a plebiscite, the Mongolian people indicate their desire for such independence. 4. The principal Manchurian railways are now combined into one line, to be jointly owned and operated by China and the USSR for a period of 40 years, after which time the entire railway shall revert to China without additional payment. 5. The Chinese government declares Darien a free port, open to the shipping of all nations. The port shall remain free for 30 years. 6. Port Arthur is to be used jointly by China and Russia as a naval base. It will revert fully to China in 30 years. And finally, the Soviets give promise that within 3 weeks of Japanese capitulation, they will start withdrawing their troops from Manchuria. This is Ed Sauder, Jr. speaking from Chungking.
This is Don Mosley of the CBS Shortwave Monitoring Staff in San Francisco. Whenever the Japanese begin to talk about how calm and unruffled they are in the face of some emergency, you can be pretty certain that actually they're just the reverse. And today it's clear that the Japs have a bad case of occupation jitters. The people are utterly calm, said Tokyo in one breath in a broadcast beam to this country. But 5 minutes later, the Jap radio was telling its own people, we must absolutely avoid unnecessary confusion and become completely calm, even though Allied planes are flying over our heads. The Japanese, in fact, seem to be having trouble assessing their own frame of mind in this crisis. The first reaction to the Emperor's surrender rescript was vast excitement and confusion. The decision to quit the war came as a profound shock to perhaps the vast majority of Japanese, and as the Jap broadcast told us, many a Japanese army man resented and disapproved. There seems little doubt now that the Emperor's prestige in those first few days met its gravest and most precarious test since Japan's Middle Ages. But whatever doubt there may have been at first, the Emperor's potency as a ruling force has now proved itself, and there's little doubt that the peace policy as a whole will prevail. The period since the Jap announcement accepting surrender has been a busy one for the old familiar group of war-guilty Japanese government leaders. They have used all the facilities available, including Tokyo Radio, to try and convince the world of their piety. These men who led the Japs to war and perpetrated Japan's worst crimes would now have us believe they are best fitted to rule Japan in the post-war era. This past week, they have tried with little success to sweep a vast amount of dirt under the rug. The tone of almost all the enemy broadcasts has been one of smug non-repentance, reflecting the mad scramble of those unchanged leaders to save their own hides. The attempt, fortunately, has been quite transparent. And with the fleet now preparing to enter Tokyo Bay, we should be hearing Radio Tokyo sing a much different tone in a very short time. I return you to Admiral in New York.
Next, a report from London, where the abrupt ending of Lend-Lease is making the biggest news. Admiral takes you to London, Charles Collingwood reporting.
The great British liner, Queen Elizabeth, sailed out of Southampton today with 15,000 American soldiers aboard bound for New York. Time was when such transportation cost the United States government nothing, but was written off against Lend-Lease. Now that Lend-Lease has been canceled, reverse Lend-Lease has been canceled too, and presumably the United States will have to pay the passage of every American soldier brought home in a British ship. British economists are today pointing out that the termination of Lend-Lease cuts both ways. Besides reverse Lend-Lease goods and services like passage on the Queen Elizabeth, there is the larger and more complicated question of world trade in general. Next to Canada, Great Britain is America's biggest customer. If, as some economists say, full employment and prosperity in America depend on foreign trade, then we cannot afford to lose the British market. But with the sudden termination of Lend-Lease and the emphasis on dollar payments for everything they buy, the British say they may be forced to buy as little as possible from the United States and to concentrate on barter agreements and deals within the empire. That is, of course, just what we don't want. The whole American policy is toward freer trade. That's the economist's way of looking at it. But let me tell you a little about the confused point of view of the British civilian. With the sudden end of the war, he sees the end of the share and share alike spirit with which the war was won and which was held up as an imperishable ideal. Now he has to get back to the old every man for himself ideal. He is morally confused. He doesn't want anything he doesn't deserve. But on the other hand, during the war, Lend-Lease wasn't charity, and he can't see that things are really very different now. It is, perhaps, that the whole concept of Lend-Lease was a little too big for our times. This is Charles Collingwood in London, returning you to Admiral in New York.
France today is watching the progress of General de Gaulle's visit to the United States. Admiral takes you now to CBS Paris, Douglas Edwards reporting.
We are very good friends now, is it not so? That's what a Frenchman said to me this morning. He'd been following very closely General de Gaulle's visit to President Truman, and although there's been an undercurrent of feeling that perhaps the mission might not have been so successful as has been documented or hoped, it still has not failed. And he seemed to think that France may at least have pulled alongside of England in America's affection. I found that to be a pretty general belief here in Paris, and there are even those who think France may have overhauled Britain in that regard. Well, whatever the results, France is confident of some help from America. Food, perhaps some coal, machinery, textiles, and clothing. And on that subject, I know where you can buy here in Paris one faded red sweater made of ersatz yarn and second hand. I know where that woman's sweater, which is several years old, can be purchased for 56 American dollars in the working class neighborhood of Paris. But not everybody has that information, and the trees are beginning to turn brown in spots along the Seine. And still the French are hopeful of a helping hand, and they're not depressed at the news from Washington concerning the de Gaulle trip. Now, here's something America has been told and told time and again while this war has been going on. Write letters, send packages to the boys overseas. I'd like to punch that one home again and again, now even with more vigor than in the past, because now is a very critical time over here in Europe. The war is over, the men are not idle, but they're not very busy. They have a great deal more spare time on their hands, and most of all, they're in danger of a tremendous boredom and impatience, because they're sweating it out. They're sweating out the biggest event in their lives in many years, and that is getting home and getting out of the army. So take it from somebody who sees the boys every day, who chats with them while they're on leave here in Paris. Keep those letters coming. They're even more vital now than they were a year ago. And this is Douglas Edwards in Paris, returning into Admiral in New York.
And now to tell you about a new kind of refrigerator with a built-in ultraviolet ray lamp to kill bacteria, here is Warren Sweeney.
It's the Sterilamp in the post-war Admiral dual-temp refrigerator. Low temperatures alone cannot always prevent foods from spoiling. Mold and gradual decay are proof that bacteria are present. But in the Admiral dual-temp, the scientific Sterilamp destroys bacteria on exposed food surfaces and in the surrounding air. Foods will stay fresh and wholesome for a longer period. The ultraviolet rays from the Sterilamp are as safe as sunshine. Their sanitizing action retards mold growth, reduces spoilage due to bacteria, and neutralizes offensive odors. You'll find Sterilamp in the post-war Admiral Dual Temp, the refrigerator that is really two refrigerators in one. But to find out more about Sterilamp and other exclusive features of the Admiral Dual Temp, as well as Admiral radios and other Admiral major appliances, why don't you write today for Admiral's new, highly colored, free booklet entitled, It's a Promise from Admiral. To get your copy, simply write your name and address on a penny postcard, then mail it to Admiral in care of the radio station to which you are now listening. Well, that's easy, isn't it? Just your name and address mailed to Admiral in care of this station. The demands on the nation's food supply are greater than ever this year. Farmers have been asked to continue their high rate of food production, and they need help. 4 million part-time farm workers are needed to help harvest the 1945 crop. Part-time work will draw prevailing farm wages. Everyone, with or without farm experience, men, women, boys, or girls, can help with as much time as they can spare. Get in touch with your county agricultural agent or your local farm employment office immediately. World News Today is brought to you each Sunday at this hour by Admiral Corporation, makers of Admiral Radio, America's Smart Set, Admiral Dual Temp Refrigerators, Admiral Home Freezers, Admiral Electric Ranges. Be sure to listen again next Sunday when Admiral brings you World News Today by shortwave direct from leading news centers of the world. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
The WBBM Air Theater, Wrigley Building, Chicago. The following announcement is transcribed.